The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on May 1, 2019. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good evening, everyone. Sorry for that. You know, I printed another thing up today and the same thing happened where I meant to print one page and I realized that page two of it was actually empty. It was a different document. And I forgot to do the current page and I had it printing every... So you know how that is. Then you realize your printer's going to be kicking out a lot of paper and you try to stop it.
And
that's right. So tonight, I thought it would be... I don't know, fun is the right word, but I was brought to mind of this poem by Rainer Maria Rilke, who is a great German language poet. I learned actually only recently, I had no idea, I hadn't really read much about his biography, but this past summer I was in Germany, Austria, and the Czech Republic, and I found out he's from the Czech Republic. Had I known, I would have made a pilgrimage to some place that he either wrote at or lived in or something like that. But I really didn't know until our bus was pulling out of the city and I started reading Rilke's Letters to a Young Poet. How's that for coincidence? And then realized, indeed, he'd come from Prague. And I went, well, I was just in Prague. But what really brought to mind this poem was I was listening to, it might have been a snippet of On Being, which is Krista Tippett's radio show. I really like the show. And she had somebody on there who was translating, had put out a new translation of Rilke poems. And then I remembered this poem, The Panther. And so I thought it would be interesting to read this poem in a way that's consonant with the teachings of the awakened, because I think that it can be read that way. And this particular poem, my understanding of it, is that it's one of the most translated into English poems by Rilke. So this, my guess is if you know Rilke, this may be the poem you know, or one of the poems you know. I first encountered it way back when I was learning how to read poetry in a great book that, don't ask me who the author is, I don't think it's in print anymore. I think it was a textbook, but I bought it like at a garage sale or something called The Act of Poetry. And this poem is in there. I have it in bilingual, not because we're going to look at the German really, but it seems like every edition I have of Rilke, that's how it's translated. There's the German and then the English translation next to it. And so I thought it would be interesting to hear it in German, and then we'll actually just focus on the English translation. Excuse my accent, it's not bad. But it's not perfect. I haven't really spoken German in a long time. I know I said I was just in Germany last summer. I hardly spoke German. I would think about, okay, this is what I need to say to the person that I'm going to buy that goulash from. And I'd be standing in line thinking, okay, and then when I say that, he's going to say this back to me, and then I'll say this, and I'd work out a whole little German dialogue. And then I would put my order in, and he'd ask me a question, and everything would just fall apart, and I'd be like, I have no idea what he just asked me. So I'd have to indicate that I couldn't speak German at all, actually. So I didn't really do a lot of speaking in German. In fact, if you just allow me, indulge me this one story, this was probably the funniest moment of speaking in German is, we'd gone from Berlin to Prague to Vienna, so all world capitals, big, huge cities. Then we went back up to Berlin. So on the last day of Berlin, we just wanted a one-day train pass. It's all we needed. And we were in this big train station, and first of all, I couldn't even find where to buy it. And I just took a guess. I went, there's an upstairs. We've covered this whole downstairs, and we haven't found what we're looking for. So I'll just go upstairs. And I found an information kiosk. So I went up to the person at the kiosk and I asked him where they were selling tickets in German. And he said, here, which means here. and it didn't look like it. I just went, here? And he said, yeah, here. And then I looked and there was a guy next to him like doing something on a computer. And I said, Fakalfish from, you know, and I was trying to figure out how to say, do I buy it from him? And that guy realized I didn't speak German, so he just pointed. And I looked, and I was at a hexagonal, the booth I was at was a hexagon. And so I just went to the next facet, and there was the ticket counter. So then I said, Zwei Tage Karten, or something like that, two one-day passes. And the guy just sat there.
Oh, brother.
And he sat there. And so we both sat there and looked at each other, because that's as much as I'd worked out in advance. I had no idea what I was supposed to say next. And so we just sat there looking at each other for, it had to have been about a minute, which is really uncomfortable. And I'm thinking, at some point he's going to ask me a question, but he just sat there. So finally I had to say, I'm sorry, I don't speak German. Oh, and then he just rang me up and pointed at the amount that I owed him. So that's as much German as I did. So that all that was just to say, excuse my accent, because I do want to read it, just so you kind of get a sense of this. And by the way, I did say this is often translated. I picked Stephen Mitchell's translation in part. He's a translator I've read other works by, and he's a good translator. And he actually tries to capture the rhyme scheme that Rilke puts in there. Some of the translations of Rilke, they don't bother. They just kind of keep it free verse, which in English actually kind of works pretty well. But so here's the poem as Rilke wrote it, Der Panther. And then that little thing in italics, that's what that first line on that second page is. It just means that it was Rilke saw this panther at an exhibit at a menagerie in, and I can't pronounce French at all, so I'd pronounce that in German, and then people would look at me like, what are you saying? But Jardin des Plantes, something like that, in Paris. So Der Panther. Sein Blick ist vom Vorübergehen der Stäbe so müd geworden, dass nichts mehr hört. Ihm ist, als ob es tausend Stäbe gäbe und hinter tausend Stäben keine Welt. Der weiche Gang, geschmeidig starke Schritte, der sich im allerkleinsten Kreise dreht, ist wie ein Tanz von Kraft um eine Mitte, in der betäubt ein großer Wille steht. Nur manchmal schiebt der Vorhang der Pupille sich lautlos auf. Dann geht ein Bild hinein, geht durch der Glieder angespannte Stille und hört im Herzen auf zu sein. And here's what it is in English. His vision, from the constantly passing bars, has grown so weary that it cannot hold anything else. It seems to him there are a thousand bars, and behind the bars, no world. As he paces in cramped circles, over and over, the movement of his powerful, soft strides is like a ritual dance around a center in which a mighty will stands paralyzed. Only at times, the curtains of the pupils lifts quietly. An image enters in, rushes down through the tensed, arrested muscles, plunges into the heart, and is gone. So that's our poem of this caged panther. This caged panther who really, for whom the whole world is its cage. And you get a sense in there of that diminished animal, that if you've gone to zoos, you see. And modern zoos, perhaps not as much, but yeah, in modern zoos, you'll say, where are the animals? Where are they? And they look not so lively. They've done things to try to correct that, but in zoos, we have the animal removed from its natural habitat. And in particular, what I'm guessing he saw in this menagerie is probably closer to what we saw in the Como Zoo. I don't know if you all went to the Como Zoo in the olden days when they had just those barred little cages. And that is what he's describing. And I think we've all seen that. The wild animal taken out of its context and, in essence, not really alive any longer, but a diminished version of what it is. And this is what that note about Steve Hagen and the puma is referring to. I don't remember where Steve brings this up. He talks about a puma in the book that has the really long title, his first book. But I don't think he brings this up in that, because there he's talking about deer and puma and deer population. But what he did talk about was how an animal, when you put animals in a zoo, that diminishment that you experience, if you've ever seen an animal out in the wild and then you see it in a zoo, you know it's just not the same. Seeing a moose in a zoo is not the same as seeing a moose out on the Gunflint Trail where it's vibrant and alive. And in the zoo, it just doesn't have that present. It doesn't have that immediacy to it. And what Steve said was that what's happening there is something that we do as human beings, which is we're mistaking the puma in this case. So we're talking about a puma that might be in the zoo or a puma that might be in the wilderness. We're making it this thing, this cat. And so then we think, well, if I take that cat and I just put it here, now we've got a puma there. And yet there's something different about that animal. It's not the same animal as it would be out in the mountain where it lives, because the animal is not just that cat. The animal is the mountain. The animal is the entirety of its life. And then we pluck it, we cut it out, and we move it to another place. It's no longer a puma. That's what I call the zuma. It's a zuma. It's a changed animal. And I had read, actually, a collection of essays by the art critic John Berger. And I don't know if you've ever read John Berger. I'm trying to see I wish I would have written this down. He has a really famous book that's all about seeing art. And it might be called The Art of Seeing. It could be what it's about. It's just about seeing. And he wrote a book I read called About Looking, which was just that, looking at things. I think it includes an essay on photography. I don't even remember what else is in there. What I remember, I read it and I thought, I want to be an essayist, and I am nowhere in the league of this guy. And this guy is very astute, very smart. And he wrote an essay about zoos. The first essay in that book is about zoos, and About Looking is called Why Look at Animals? And it's a complex essay, and I'm not going to talk about most of what he says, except to say he pointed out, and I believe I read this before I ever encountered Buddhism, this idea of how animals are changed when they're put into zoos. And he talks about that way that animals are almost catatonic in zoos. He says, this is a quote from John Berger's book, "The animals, isolated from each other and without interaction between species, have become utterly dependent on their keepers. Consequently, most of their responses have been changed. What was central to their interest has been replaced by passive waiting for a series of arbitrary outside interventions." So the cat has changed because its relationship, actually not its relationship, but now what it is. So when it lived on the mountain, it was the mountain. The puma was the mountain. It had a territory it lived in. It had an environment that it understood. It hunted. It perhaps had other animals it needed to watch out for to not be hurt itself. In the zoo, it has a different life. It has this enclosure. It doesn't really interact with other animals. And it does have interactions with these animals that are humans that come in and bring it food from time to time. So they just lie around. They don't have the same life. Now, I'm not saying this because I'm criticizing zoos. That's not really what I'm pointing out. I'm just trying to point out how the animal changes in the zoo and how I feel like that is at least something this poem is pointing to. It's what Rilke saw in that panther. That panther, he says, whose vision has grown so weary that all it sees is its cage, that paces in a small circle inside that cage. And so what we see in that panther, what we saw in that puma that I was talking about that becomes a Zuma when relocated to the zoo, is that puma is being separated out from the world it lives in when we move it and we turn it into a Zuma. And we still, when we see the Zuma, we think it's a puma. And it's not a puma anymore. Now it's a Zuma. So we're separating out this cat. It's what we do as human beings often. As we see something, we separate things. There are separate items. And then we get caught up in those ideas we have of separation. And it has caused us all kinds of problems. You can take a look at what's happening with the environment, and you know that that came from separating things out and treating things as separate systems and not understanding the whole relationship. And of course, we've changed our viewpoints, and there are other cultures that saw these things holistically to begin with. But with Western culture, for sure, industrialized culture, separation, manipulation, getting caught up in things. And it's like getting caught up in things that goes from perhaps talking about these larger issues of the ecology, maybe about the globe or about animals, and gets us down to the ethics of how we live our lives. How is it we are taking up our lives? Are we getting caught up in things? And what are the possible consequences of getting caught up in things? And that's why I want to get back to this poem again. I want to zero in now into the details of this poem and look at how I think Rilke is actually showing us that same thing. How when we get caught up with what's right there in front of us, it seems to be our whole life, and it actually seems to entrap us. So if we look at what that panther is doing, its vision, his vision, he says, from the constantly passing bars, has grown so weary that it cannot hold anything else. Those constantly passing bars. You think about that panther pacing. Well, it's in a circle. And we've seen those cages. They're bars on all sides. So that panther's just circling around in that small circle inside that cage, bars, 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 bars. That's it. And it sees, as Rilke says, to him there are 1,000 bars. 1,000 bars. You know there weren't that many in that cage, but he just keeps circling. It's 1,000 bars. And that's it. That's all the panther sees is that. Those bars. And we can do the same thing. Now, it's true that this panther is in a cage. But we in our lives find ourselves often enclosed, or we feel that our lives are enclosed. We can feel that way. I'm not saying that we do for sure. But there are moments when we just feel like life has got us in a small cage. Perhaps it's the routine of our lives. You hear people talking about being in a rut. It's the same sort of thing. And I just get up, go to my job, come home, take a nap. That's sort of describe my life. Have dinner, go back to work, go home, go to sleep, get up the next morning, go to work. And you hear that over and over, and that's the rut. It's just this thing, and nothing becomes, or nothing is alive then. And we can fixate on that. We can blame that stuff for making us feel trapped, for making us feel like we're bound or imprisoned. We look at that and go, if only I had a different job. Holy cow, let me tell you how often I did that in my life. I wasn't sure that the job was ever going to be the right thing, but I always knew it was the wrong thing. So I'd work at a job. I wasn't as bad as some friends. I had friends that they would just like do that for 2 days. That's not very trapped. You work at a job for a year or two, and that's when you start to go, why am I doing this job? Why am I doing this? And you get trapped, and so you quit the job. And then you go to the next job, and it's, why am I trapped in this job? Why am I trapped in this? And then you quit that job, the next job. And after a while, you start to realize it's really not the job's fault. They might not have been the best jobs in the world. But you don't have to make such a miserable existence out of it. I remember one of the last jobs that I had before I went into graduate school and became a professor. And I suppose that was a job too, but it didn't feel the same. But the last job I had, I remember feeling ashamed of myself because I had this coworker, and she was amazing. She was an amazing person. I cannot stress what an upbeat, wonderful person she was. And she was working the same job I was, and then I'd come in, and poison would just seep out of me all week long, and by the end of the week. And I don't think she realized I was doing this to her. And I didn't realize it until after about a year of my doing this. By the end of the week, she was in such a foul mood. And I realized I was poisoning her. And she finally quit the job. And she didn't quit it. She liked working with me, actually, which is astonishing. But I realized I was causing problems for her. And I looked at that and I went, Steve, you really got to look at your life. You got to look at what you're doing and really take stock of this. But we do this. We can so easily do this. There are the bars. It's the thing that's hampering me. It's the thing that's closing me in. And blame that and get just totally sucked into that so that your whole life is just staring at those bars and complaining about those bars. And that's your whole universe are those bars because you're pacing around in that circle. Bar, 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 bar. And that's it. And that's all that you can see. And we can be deadened by that trap. Or we think it's the trap. But what's really happening there? What is really going on? What was trapping me? And we can, again, we can say about the panther, well, he's in a cage. But I do want to say that what crossed my mind, too, while I was thinking about that, is I used to join Cal. We used to go to Stillwater Prison and teach meditation to prisoners there. And I remember that some of the people, I suspect, were going to be there for life. And I did realize when we were going there what it was that we were just sharing meditation with them, but how important, I guess, that really would be for somebody in prison for whom you could just sit and fixate on those walls and those bars and those rules and those regulations. And sometimes the guys would come into the meditation session, and it had not been a good week. Actually, we saw them once a month, so it had not been a good month. And it was so nice to be in a quiet place where we could sit. You can almost feel some of that melt off, and sometimes not. But my point is that here were people who were more in the position of the panther, and still, you don't have to fixate on those bars. That's your life right there. So can you see beyond the bars? What is it that actually is enclosing you or entrapping you? And this brings to mind a story that I shared recently in my class on Zen Koans on the Gateless Gate, which is a story that involves the 7th century Zen master, Tsengtsan. He's the third patriarch. And we know Tsengtsan from the Shinshin Ming. He's the author of the Shinshin Ming, which is trusting the heart mind. Very important teaching in Buddhism, certainly in Zen Buddhism. And it's a story about a monk that came to Tsengtsan and said, Master, show me the way to liberation. And that's one of the things you may have heard about Buddhism is that Buddhism is the path to liberation, path to freedom, to joy, to happiness. Liberation is one of those words, though. And so it's not too unusual for a monk to say, I want you to teach me how to be liberated. So show me the way to liberation. You can almost see the way as the Buddhist way. It's the way the teachings are referred to as the way. Show me the way to liberation. Sengsan replied, who binds you? And the monk replied, no one binds me. So look at the wisdom of that monk already. So a lot of times in these stories, it's easy to pass off the interrogator, like the person asking the question, as being naive. Because their question might, in a very, you know, very like a glancing fashion or just as in a very immediate way, it may seem naive. When you take a look at it, we got to realize this guy is a monk. So he has been practicing. He knows that this is the way to liberation. He understands the teachings of the Buddha. And yet, who does bind him? And he realizes that no one binds him. Sengsan then asked this very pointed question. Then why do you seek liberation? And I'm not going to provide an answer for that. These are the kinds of questions. When a master asks that, my tendency as a person who, I don't know, all my life, I guess, I've been used to filling in the answers. You know, so I do remember a moment when I was a child. So I liked giving answers. This is what I like. I liked investigating. I liked watching, when I was a kid, Quincy, Medical Examiner. Oh, yeah. Do you remember that show? Yeah. So one of those mystery shows. And I guess nowadays it would be like the, I don't know what the shows are, CIS or CSI or whatever they are. But those procedural cop shows. I kind of like that. I like reading Sherlock Holmes stories. And I was in fifth grade, and when we entered the classroom that day, the fish tank, the water was purple in it. And everyone was like, oh, the water's purple. You know, fifth graders, it's like, that's pretty exciting. And so the teacher thought, this is a teachable moment. He said, why do you think that the water is purple? And we couldn't really figure it out. And then he said to one of the students, whose name was Clem, he said, Clem, this is how these things burn into your memory. I remember it was Clem's paper. He said, Clem, where is your paper? And then I stood up, and I started looking. He goes, Matushak, what are you doing? I said, I'm looking for Clem's. I didn't tell you to stand up. Sit down. So my tendency is to want to put an answer there. But when a Zen master asks, then why do you seek liberation? This is a question to point you back to reality, not to come up with an answer. Well, I want to seek liberation because I don't feel so, you know. It's not that. And again, the monk knows this. This is about really looking at your life, really seeing what it is that's showing up. And that is what it is right now that this panther is unable to do. The panther is unable to really look at its life. You know, as we see from that first stanza, his vision has grown so weary that it cannot hold anything else. Even more pointedly is in the third stanza, when we have that amazing image, it says only at times the curtain of the pupils lifts quietly. I remember the first time I read that. He's not saying that there are curtains over the eyes. He's saying that the curtains are the eyes. They're the pupils. They're the way of seeing. The way of seeing themselves veil what? Well, that's a good question. That's what? What is it that's sort of beyond those bars or behind those bars? What in this poem would be Rilke pointing to the world? But its reality is it's actually showing up. So the curtain of the pupils lifts quietly, only at times. So the way of seeing itself is getting in the way. And again, that way of seeing that I was talking about before is how we get caught up in separation and thingness. We get caught up in that. It just shows up and we are mesmerized by it. Just again, like you can imagine, those constantly moving bars might be almost hypnotic for the panther. We get mesmerized by objects. It's so easy to do. I make reference to this, and I think maybe some of you have only seen this, but when Steve used to teach, now I don't remember what class it was. It might have been Dependent or Rising. But he would bring a little monkey out. Was it Dependent or Rising he would do that with? Yeah, George. He wouldn't tell us what it was. George was something in a bag, as I recall. And then he pulled George out, and it was a stuffed monkey. And Steve would animate it just a little bit, just kind of move its head. And we were there. There was a veil over our eyes as we were completely caught up in the thingness of George. And all Steve was showing us is how immediate that objectification is. How we immediately, there's something out there, and I'm seeing it. And you really can get caught up in that pretty easily. And I saw how mesmerizing that is. A few years earlier than I saw Steve with George, we were trying to entertain my husband's nephews. And they were little kids, 3 years old, maybe four. And so we put on a little show for them. And I realized that stuffed animals can really, like if you move them a certain way, they can kind of look a little real. And I was doing that, and those kids were totally sucked into that. So that's how mesmerizing that can be. That's the curtain, the way that we see as we get caught up in this thing. We're seeing things in a way that mesmerize us and in a way fool us. And that's why often in translations into English of talking about people who are caught up in thingness, which is most of us most of the time, we're called fools. Because we're fooled by what's actually taking place. We get caught up in the appearances and how things appear to be. And if you see then for this panther, at times the curtain of the pupils lift quietly. And this, to me, I'm going to come back to this middle yet, because this is where I think there might be some hope, perhaps. But in the end, this is where, we're talking about this is heavy. Heavy reading, this is where it gets heavy, because only at times the curtain of the pupils lifts quietly. So you think about those moments we have where there is clarity, where we taste what's really showing up. And we don't have to study Buddhism for that. And as I have taken up this practice, I couldn't help but think of moments I had when I was a child, sitting in my grandparents' living room. In the afternoon sun, it's completely quiet, watching dust motes in the air. And there's this openness, there's this. So we taste reality, and we taste it because it's always going on. So every once in a while, we let our guard down. We are not being hypnotized by the way that we think the world is. And for this panther, an image enters in, rushes down through the tensed, arrested muscles. So we have this animal that, the muscles are tense and they're arrested. It's not allowed to be a panther. It's not allowed to be a panther. It's like that Zuma I was talking about. Now it's a different animal. So what its power is arrested. It's stopped. It's tensed. And that image enters in, goes through that, plunges into the heart. Trusting the heart mind, Seng San's poem. The heart in Chinese, Xin Xin, I don't know. Is it Xin Xin that's heart? Is it Xin Xin that's heart mind? Xin Xin?
Trusting the heart mind.
Well, but that's the Xin Xin Min.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So, but I think Xin Xin is heart mind. But it doesn't matter. Those things come together. We in the West, again, really want to separate those. There's Mr. Spock, right? If you think in classic Star Trek, there's Mr. Spock. He's the cold, rational one, no emotions. Though I will tell you right now, the secret behind that show is Leonard Nimoy was probably the best actor of those three guys. So he already was an actor of cool composure. He cried and he yelled at people. He had emotions all over the place. He was just such a good actor. And of course, that was when Spock was breaking his vault. He was like playing into his human side when he was doing that. But he did it a lot. But anyhow, there's the Vulcan, there's Spock, who's the emotional one, or the intellectual one, the rational one. The logical one is a word he uses. And then there's McCoy. He's actually on the other side of the spectrum. He's crazy. When I was a kid, he scared me. And he's just like really emotional. And that's the West. Dr. McCoy. Bones. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And he was like a southern, you know, moonshine drinking backwoods doctor. And the things he would say about Spock, even as a little kid, they'd make my ears hurt. I'd be like, that's not nice. They were pretty horrible. So he was very volatile, very emotional. And then you had Kirk, and Kirk kind of balanced the two.
Yeah.
That's absolutely right. So the way we normally think of things is we separate those two, but we don't do that, right? There's no separation in our teaching. So that image plunges into the heart and is gone. So for this panther, the panther can't see what it is that it's seeing. It can't see it because it's so caught up in its immediate, what it is that's perturbing it, that its vision has grown so weary it can't hold anything else. I mean, it really can't register what's taking place. And I would say that this is the plight of most people. We're living in liberation. We're living right here in freedom and enlightenment. And I would guess most people would say, what? No, I'm not. Even when you get a taste of it, you don't. It just goes right to the heart, and is gone. And it's a very, to me, it's emotional. It's heartbreaking to think that that is the plight that we find ourselves in. But we do, and this is actually something to think about. This is part of the compassion of Buddhism. When you're encountering others, think of this panther. We're all like that. You know, you go, well, yeah, of course the images go and die in his heart, but not in my heart. So it's time to open up and just realize that this is a pretty common, easy way to get caught up in the world. And for that image, and we'll say that glimpse of reality, to just sort of die on the vine as we're still worked up about whatever it is we might be worked up about. Or we don't even have to be worked up. You could be in love with it. It could be something we're really passionate about. And that in and of itself can get pretty crazy. I'm passionate about movies, but I'm not as passionate about movies as some friends of mine. I mean, I see about 100, 110 movies in a year, which sounds like a lot, but I think most people watch actually more than that. But so I have friends who watch more than 300 movies in a year. That's passion, and it's kind of a problem. And one of my friends even said that. He goes, you know, I think I sat in front of screens a little too often last year. And I said, yeah, I'd say so. That's a lot of time. And he watches the kind of movies I do. So those running times are run 2.5, 3.5 hours. Whew. A lot of time sitting and watching stuff. So even our passions can distract us and pull us away from this, from just this. And just as an example of how easily, again, we get caught up and miss what it is that reality is showing up as all the time. There is another story that I will at least raise in my next Gateless Gate class, which is, because it's one of the many koans that I linked to the Fox koan. So that for some reason I linked all those koans, and then we had a long koan. This is the one that's called, I think it's called Cypress Tree in the Garden in the Cleary translation. It's often called Oak Tree in the Garden. And it's in the Gateless Gate. And the Gateless Gate, I was talking about this. The Gateless Gate is a very well-known koan collection. It's one of the, you know, say three best-known koan collections. And koans are these brief Zen teachings. They're sort of a cross between almost a story and a poem. Except the stories are usually perplexing and not usually. Well, they can be entertaining, actually. They can be pretty funny. But the Gateless Gate really cuts them down, right down to the bare essence. So the way it shows up in the gateless gate is. So this is case 38 in the gateless gate. Oak tree in the garden. A monk asked Joshu, and Joshu is one of the great Zen masters. This guy lived till he was 120 years old and really studied pretty deeply, was enlightened at the age of 18. That is, he really saw what was going on at the age of 18 and continued to study with his master for another 40 years beyond that, which means he was about 60. And then in ancient China, where it wasn't necessarily easy to travel around, he traveled around to different Zen centers for another 20 years. So he's about 60. In ancient China, traveling around to deepen his practice. And then finally at 80, settles down. So this guy really sat with and lived this practice. He was very, very serious about it. So a monk asked Joshu why Bodhidharma came to China. This is one of those questions. It basically means, what's the nature of reality? Trust me, I don't want to go into that, but I think, Norm, you don't even bother with the Bodhidharma stuff. You just go, what's the nature of reality? And Joshu said, an oak tree in the garden. And we might think, well, yeah, because, you know, there are oak trees, there are chairs. He could have said anything, and that's the nature of reality. But that's not what Joshu is pointing out, our usual way of seeing things. He's actually helping us to see that that oak tree in the garden is really reality showing itself to us, not in this limited sense we have, in the sense that the panther has of just seeing those bars. We'll see an oak tree and we separate it out. It becomes an oak tree. It just becomes this thing. But remember that puma that I was talking about, that's the mountain. Same thing with the panther. It is where they snatched that panther from. And now they've transplanted it. The oak tree is everything. It's all beings showing up. Did you say the whole universe showing up as oak tree, is what Joshu is pointing out to the student. There is a longer version of this koan, because I've heard Norm tell it, and I had to look it up online. I'm going, I know Norm has told this one, so I'm going to look, and I'm going to try to find it. Now, is it in Book of Serenity that it's the longer version, or is it still the short version?
The oak tree?
Yeah.
Zen comments on the Mumon Tan by Zenkai Shibayama. Yeah. There are a number of different sections of it in there.
Yeah. Well, I'll read it to you. It really doesn't matter. It's just I part of me wants to be able to cite where it's from, but I'm unable to do it. Because you find these teachings all over the place, and teachers don't always tell you where they got their stuff. So, but here's the longer version of it that kind of helps you to see, again, what it is that we do. So remember, we've got a monk here. He's asking his teacher, what's the nature of reality? And when they do that, as I pointed out in my class, when students are asking their masters that, they want to really see their master. And what that really means is they want to see the master's true self, the master's original nature. They want a taste of, I don't know, that's going too far. But they really want, they're trying to plumb the depths. They're not just asking a simple question when they ask, what's the nature of reality? So when Joshu says an oak tree in the garden, we would hope, if you're asking the master, what's the nature of reality, that you're not going to then go, and that's kind of what, in this longer exchange, it looks a little bit like the monk does. So, but it could be he's just trying to sense the depth of Joshu's answer, because perhaps he himself knows intellectually that that could be an answer, but he's just trying to figure out, okay. So the longer version is this. A monk asked Joshu what the living meaning of Chan Buddhism is. So that's a translation I have for that. So that's interesting. See, it doesn't say anything about Bodhidharma coming from China. What the living meaning of Chan Buddhism is. And Joshu said, the cypress tree in the yard, or the oak tree in the yard. And the monk said, teacher, don't use an object to guide people. So this, at least the way the monk is articulating this is, well, a tree is an object, and objects, we realize that we can't really locate what that object is. I mean, we can point that and say, well, it's that thing right there, but if we really look at that object, we'll realize that's not all it is, that so much more is showing up. It's showing up as, say, that chair right there, Or is Mike sitting there? It's showing up as that. So the monk said, "Teacher, don't use an object to guide people." And Joshu said, "I'm not using an object to guide anyone." Both of those are important. So the monk has in it both the object and the people who are looking at the object, the people who are taking up the studying. And Joshu helps to clarify what he's saying to the student by saying, "I'm not using an object, oak tree in the garden, not using an object to guide anyone. So there's no particular person that I'm using to guide." So the monk repeats his question. He says, "Then what's the meaning of Chan Buddhism? Okay, if you're not using an object to guide people, then what is the meaning of reality?" And Joshu said, "The cypress tree in the yard." And again, that's one of those things. We can talk about it all you want to, but if you really see what he's talking about, that that's not an object, that that cypress tree in the yard is expressing reality. That's what you sit with, is to sit and see that point is pointing right toward that. And so to be with that is our practice. And that is what this panther right now is incapable of doing, right? It can't, it just can't sit with that, so to speak. So it's pacing around and around in its cage. But like I said, it's that middle stanza that kind of interests me. So we have him pacing in these cramped circles over and over. The movement of his powerful, soft strides. You know that? That movement of a big cat. It's beautiful. It is really beautiful. Those soft strides. Powerful. Just so much power in them. And again, that's what's tensed and arrested in that last stanza, is that those powerful, soft strides. And Rilke tells us that the movement, that circle around and around, is like a ritual dance around a center in which a mighty will stands paralyzed. And that, to me, it's that center that is that around which we keep circling and we keep circling, and that is actually expressing itself, inner circling around it and around it. So that mighty will, we think of will as being something, I'm going to go do this, but you just think of will as action. It's just this, we could say, this unfolding. The panther's movement, small movement, is like a ritual dance around that movement that, you know, it's articulated as a will here, because it's like the potential for movement. It's like, you know, the source of what it is that we do. And that's what the panther is circling around. It is expressing that mighty will, that potential for whatever it is we do. It's expressing that in that small circle. That's how it's expressing what's at the center. That's how it's expressing reality. And again, that's what we do when we get caught up, when we get fooled, and we lose our minds or you know, whatever it is we do. When we get caught up in it, we're still expressing reality. And this is important to point out, because when we go back, when we think about that story between the monk and Sengsan, in a way what the monk is asking Sengsan, you know, "I want you to liberate me. Show me liberation, the path, the way to liberation," is that he wants to express his true self. That's the way to liberation. And yet you're always expressing your true self. That is what we're waking up to. We're waking up to how we get caught up in the way that we understand things, and we're waking up to the fact that we're always expressing this reality. So whatever it is that's showing up. So again, we you know, it could be our job, it could be, oh, I don't know, we didn't do so well on a test, or we got in an accident, or again, we really like going to movies, or I'm really enjoying this chocolate cake right now, or, you know, whatever it is that's going on, or I'm really in love with this person right now. or I'm taking care of a dog right now for a friend. And I when I was a kid, I had a dog. So I love dogs, but I just don't want to make the time in my life to take care of one. So I was glad to have the opportunity to go over to somebody's house and take care of this dog. And I love that dog. You know, I won't see it probably for a long time after Saturday. But I'm really enjoying it. I'm noticing I have some of the dog on my Rockasoo right now. It's a white husky, very beautiful dog. And it's a rescue dog, so it's also very peculiar. And I love peculiar animals. And my cat, I won't go too far into this, except I'm talking about, see, now we're getting caught up. And this is realizing that this is expressing the true self, too. But my cat, her version of playing sometimes is just to go back behind the door, be like a door open in a room, and she would peek at you through the crack. And that would be the extent of the playing. Because you'd bend down and you'd say her name and then she'd just tip over on her side. And that was it. But she really enjoyed that. So that's peculiar. And this dog, what she does is she runs over to this mound in the yard and then she just sits there and watches you. And she's really excited that you're there. In fact, every once in a while she'll run across the yard and then she runs back to the mound and sits down again and just watches you. She's so happy that you're there watching her sit on that mound. That's her version of playing. But we get caught up and we don't realize that this is the true self. So we'll get caught up in that love for that dog, for example, and that's going to hurt. And it's not that, that's life, right? I mean, that's sort of what happens. But we don't have to get so caught up in it that it's going to devastate. It's not going to be devastating to me, but it'll be a little sad. I probably won't see Becky. Her name is Becky. What kind of a dog name is that? But I won't see Becky probably for a while. And, you know, and that'll kind of hurt. But that's the way we get caught up. And we can really get caught up in that and lose track of life and just think, oh, this is so miserable. Or again, this is so great. I want this to go on forever. And we miss the true self expressing itself. I wanted to read to you a little passage from Shunryu Suzuki's Not Always So. Shunryu Suzuki, most of you know, but he's a great 20th century Zen master. His masterpiece is Zen Mind and Beginner's Mind, but this book is not so bad. It's a pretty good book. And we're reading this section right now in the study group that we have on Thursday mornings. The chapter that this appears in is called Wherever I Go, I Meet Myself. Is a really important teaching in Zen Buddhism, that everything that's showing up, remember I told you the whole universe is showing up as that tree. You're part of the whole universe. That's not quite the right way to put it, but you're showing up as that tree. That experience of that tree, that's you expressing, you know, fully expressing right there. And that's what Suzuki is kind of helping us to see. I meet myself wherever I go. And so just in a way, I feel like he's trying to be our friend when he's talking about this. So he says, if people say you are crazy, and then he's just got a response, okay, I'm crazy. If people say you are a bad student, it may be so. I am a bad student, but I am trying pretty hard. That is enough. When you sit in that way, I'm crazy. Okay, I'm a bad student, but I'm trying pretty hard. When you sit in that way, you accept yourself and accept everything together with yourself. When you're involved in various silly problems, you sit with the problems you have. That is you at that time. When you try to get out of your problems, that is already wrong practice. And it's only wrong in this way. You're still like that panther. You're still going around and around and around, not seeing what's actually taking place, missing what is in plain sight. And my talk went on way longer than I thought it would. I don't know, do people have any questions or comments? Yeah, Pat.
Quick one. With regard to the panther situation, the one thing that I always get caught up on is, you know, the people that are wrongfully accused of something and, you know, get put in prison, and, you know, and they have family and stuff and they get put in for 20 years and then, you know, their life is, you know, quote unquote taken away from them. And how are they, you know, how you're present with that. I don't know. Can you speak to that at all? Or just,
well,
like,
I can't.
Yeah.
No, I really can't. And I don't think anybody really can, because you deal with life as it shows up. That's what Suzuki is pointing out. However you deal with it, that is how you're dealing with it right at that time. So being present with it doesn't mean that you're not going to be upset. Though I'm going to tell you, you don't have to be. Right? So I'm not saying that it's right not to be upset. I'm just saying you don't have to be. I've heard interviews with people who've been wrongfully imprisoned. They have a different attitude than you might think. And part of it is just, if they're exonerated especially, joy. Joy. And sometimes something happens in prison. So there's not always acrimony. There's not always hatred. Sure, there's some regret. I missed a lot of years. I missed my family. But I really don't know. How you handle it is how reality is showing up. That is what you have to live with, is how you are living that. That's what you have to sit with. You know, talk about, you know, sitting with reality or whatever. That's what's showing up. That's what's to be lived. So you could be in absolute misery. That is you at that moment in practice. Can you be there with that? And I can't, you know, I can't tell you how to do that. There's no one way to do it. There's not, you may not be able to do that. It might be pretty darn hard. And I'm guessing from moment to moment, it's going to be different. Sometimes it's probably awful. Think about those guys again in the prison. Yeah. And sometimes the guys would show up and they, you know, you can't, I suppose you can. I was going to say you can't be miserable all the time, you know. But sometimes these guys would not be, and sometimes they would be. So I don't know if that helps, but really our tendency is to want to think with this teaching that it's about, you know, kind of living, that living with something or being it is to be okay with it, and that's not necessarily true. Yeah. All right, well, I kept you here a couple minutes late, so thank you all for coming tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.